The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/Skiffy and Fanny, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/Skiffy and Fanny and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 179.
The Logic of Empire with Anne Leckie.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And obviously our special guest today is Anne Leckie. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much.
So before we get started right off, we happen to have an extra copy of Ancillary Justice, which is the book we're talking about today, Anne's book. So we're going to do a giveaway to whoever. It can open to basically anywhere I can actually ship books to. There are still places I can't ship books to, like the moon or the International Space Station, which is unfortunate.
That would be awesome.
I know. Why isn't SpaceX on top of this?
To send books to the space station?
Should be their whole job. They should just have like one shuttle dedicated to sending cool stuff to astronauts.
I totally think so, yes.
Yeah, that'd probably be way too expensive. Anyway, but in any case, so we got an extra book, and basically all you have to do is this. You can email us at skiffyandfanny@gmail.com. You can go to skiffyandfanny.com and just look for this particular post. It'll be episode 179. Or you can tweet us, if you so choose, at skiffyandfanny. Basically, just tell us this. What is your favorite science fiction novel? Don't care which one it is. We're going to pick at random, but I want to know what your favorite is, and that's why we do it. And then we'll pick at random, and we'll basically announce it and send the book to you. So that's it. So you can win a book, and it's an awesome book. And as we were talking off podcast, and the cover, as I said, was sexy. Mm-hmm. And Paul thought we should mention the cover and have you talk a little bit about it. So who did the cover?
Jonathan Harris is the artist who's done a bunch of really fabulous covers. And I was really excited when I saw it. I thought it was just the most gorgeous thing. It's just, I love my cover so much.
God, it is beautiful. By the way, the cover for the advanced proof is different than the cover that comes for like the official book.
Yes, and in fact, actually, he did one big painting that is divided into three. So 1/3 of the painting is the cover for book one, and the 1/3 of the painting is the cover for book two, and 1/3 for book three. And what you got was actually on the arc was just like a different segment of the painting.
Oh, that is so cool! So I got like a special thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
So in fact, what you could almost do is you could get all the books and somehow hunt down an arc and then actually put them together to get the full painting.
Well, I guess the part that's on the arc will be on, I think it's sort of between book two and three. So if you line up all three books, it'll make the whole picture.
That'd be cool.
But the arc is like one tiny part of that whole big picture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I know it makes sense. And I actually think that's really a nifty idea because that doesn't happen very often. Except for like special re-releases of books where the covers match.
And when I heard about that, I was really excited.
It adds a kind of collectible aspect to the books, which I like. I like that idea since I am a book nut and my apartment is basically just books and a cat. So so that actually gives me a real... Oh, this is going to be so cool. I'm gonna now have to buy another copy for myself just that isn't the art copy. I'm going to buy 10 million of them. So...
You go ahead, right ahead and do that.
I will, and I'll be bankrupt, and you'll see me in court, like, begging the government not to take my house, even though I don't own a house.
You'll build it out of books.
I'll build it out of books, yeah. So, so great. So the author, Mr. Harris, I'll hunt down a link and make sure to put that in so people can check out his work. And do check out the books when you get a chance. So let's get started right off the bat with A really quick question about the book itself. So Ancillary Justice, as you've already indicated, is the first in a trilogy of, I guess you describe them sort of space opera, military, science fiction, sort of a merger?
I usually say pretty much straight ahead space opera, but a lot of space opera has a lot of similarities with military. Obviously, you know, there's almost always armies and wars and whatnot. I don't know how much I'd call this a military science fiction, but I can see somebody calling it that, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure. It certainly has the military aspect in it, but I guess you could also argue that it's just more of a strict space opera.
Yeah.
In terms of its scale, because it is quite a massive scale. So tell us a bit about the main thrust of this first book, Ancillary Justice.
The main thrust, essentially the main character, the narrator, is a starship that's had something terrible happen to it and is reduced to one single human body that used to be part of its, you know, part of its whole body, essentially looking for revenge for what happened to it. That's basically what goes on with that book.
And it takes place in two different perspectives, or I guess you could almost say time periods. It wasn't clear to me at first, but I think that if I recall correctly, they are separate time periods. One is the present and one is the past.
Exactly. Yeah. One is the present where she's just the one human body. And then the past timeline is what led up to her becoming that.
One of the interesting things I thought about this idea, because just so everybody knows it, that the way in which this works and why the title is kind of important is the spaceship has multiple bodies, which it uses basically like sets of eyes, and it can sort of keep track of all kinds of information by this, watching the city, et cetera, all these kinds mm-hmm. of things. It's sort of like a giant surveillance system, but for a spaceship. So like the past narrative is actually told very uniquely by these different sets of eyes. So in fact, rather than having a story where, you know, one moment your character's like, well, I'm having a nice day and I'm going to go to the beach. And then the next second it's like, but then all of a sudden we're somewhere else. It's actually makes sense within the context why we're switching, because the character actually says, well, I'm looking through this different set of eyes now, and here's what I'm seeing going on there, and then switching again. So it actually becomes a unique sort of narrative device in a way.
Yeah, she can be in more than one place at once. Yeah.
So what was the kind of impetus for creating the ancillaries and this sort of web of selves, I guess you could say?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think, you know, you just kind of play around with ideas and play around with settings. And the idea of bodies slaved to a computer, right, is kind of a trope in some ways. But you start playing with it and turning it around and think, well, how is that going to work? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, that would be really cool. I mean, I wouldn't not like it would be really cool to be or anything, but that would really be a cool thing to explore. I wouldn't want to be an ancillary. And so I just kind of played with it for a long time.
Well, and of course, the ancillary, to become an ancillary is not a great process.
No, it's not a lot of fun. No.
I won't ruin it because people should read the book because it's revealed. I think it's first revealed like around page 80 or something like that. How the ancillaries come about, where they get all the ancillaries. And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Because not so fun. One of the other main things here is, of course, the ship. People who don't have who will be getting the fresh edition won't get this nifty different cover, which says "Justice will come to Empire." Which
no,
I think is actually a really cool tagline. And the main sort of world we're dealing with is actually essentially a massive empire, and so the past narrative is set in a world that has been annexed into this grand empire of sorts. And I'm curious as while a lot of space opera obviously deals with empires, I can't think of many really big examples that actually explore the sort of social and political consequences of empire, which your book I think really does quite well in dealing with the sort of politics of this this planet that's been annexed and the problems that now arise over trying to basically integrated into the larger body. So Were you did you do a lot of research at all to kind of make this feel more real, or was it just something that kind of came to you?
I actually did a fair amount of research. I spent a long time thinking about this book, partly because the narrator was going to be so challenging. I was really afraid of starting to write it. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about it and reading different stuff. And it occurred to me at one point, you know, like you say, the Empire is really common, the whole Galactic Empire thing. But then I asked myself, well, what does that mean? In the real world, how do empires actually work? And why is the Empire so fascinating for science fiction? And ultimately, I said, well, you know, science fiction, at least the way that we define it, has a really strong origin in a period in our history when European countries were really involved in invading other places and taking them over. And I said, so maybe I want to look at that historically, how that worked. And that really got me reading stuff about colonialism. And I started really thinking about a lot of that. And I don't know if I necessarily did all of that justice, but it was really fascinating and to some extent really disturbing and saddening to read some of that. But yeah, I did a fair amount of reading about that particular issue.
Excellent. So, Paul, I see you have your first hand. So jump in.
It actually and more or less answered my question, although I was looking for more specifics on what historical models, if any, from empires in the past that you used in creating the Ratchai Empire.
I tried not to model too strongly. I didn't want the Ratchai to be a specific historical empire transferred to space, but I did look at Rome. I looked really hard at Rome because it was a huge empire functioning for a very long time over very large distances. The distances were functionally larger than they are today, because of, you know, differences in technology and communication. And I looked some at the British Empire as well, but I didn't try and transfer either of those, you know, like into space.
Mm. One of the things I was actually thinking when I was reading the book, and I don't know why, because it does, like you say, you didn't intend to map, and I don't think it does quite map onto any particular form, but I kept thinking of the United States and Hawaii.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I wasn't thinking as much about the U.S. as I probably should have been, but it's not like the U.S. hasn't done some of that stuff, too.
Oh, yeah, it's done plenty. It's had its fair shake, still maybe kinda, depending on your perspective, not having so much fun. And then people wonder why certain countries don't like us. It's like, well, I don't know, you know, maybe because we take their stuff. But anyway, I'm sorry, that was political. Interestingly enough, that you mentioned Rome, and I do find that interesting in the context of the story, because while this is taking place fairly far into the future, and it involves a lot of elements that maybe are quite common to space opera, but are almost like fantasy elements, in terms of there's a lot of discussion about the religions, and particular characters have multi-god religions. That they believe in. There's actually discussions of prayer and song that are related to the specific religions. Oh my gosh, I can't remember the... I'm going to just butcher names, so I just won't bother trying. because there are a lot of really just complex names. And I was interested in exploring those sort of religious ideas in the sort of fantastic element, or what seem to be staples for like epic fantasy, I guess, but are presented here. What were you imagining in terms of the religion in this sort of a future or this sort of world?
Well, I guess I think you make a really good point that science fiction doesn't deal as explicitly with religion as fantasy often does. And I think that's kind of a mistake. I think there's kind of an assumption sometimes, or it feels like there's an assumption, that the future will be sort of religionless, or that religion won't be as important. And I'm myself an atheist, but I don't see that religion's going anywhere anytime soon. And so it seems to me it's something that needs to be there in the future. But I also didn't want to just draw a straight line from some religion that exists now and just transplant it in the future as though that's going to be the only religion. There has to be, in my mind, some kind of diversity, something different. And so I was trying to put together something that felt like it was real, like humans would really do it, but that wasn't exactly like something that we have here today.
Well, and you couldn't just have something that's like today, because, I mean, in the last, you know, 200, 300 years alone, I mean, Christianity, just that one religion, has changed drastically.
It certainly has, and broken off into 40 million different varieties, each one with their own ideas about everything. Yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
And polytheism is kind of fun because, well, first of all, I could do the Roman thing, right, where you say, right, well, that God is obviously the same as our God. They just have a different name, and that was very useful. You know, so polytheism was useful that way.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry, and I noticed even between the two timelines, there's slightly different approaches to how the characters seem to approach religion. Or maybe I was reading too much into that. It seems like the earlier timeline seemed a little more religious and more concerned with that as religion, and the present timeline's a little more skeptical. Or am I just overreading that, Anne?
Oh, that's an interesting observation. I think the earlier timeline, of course, is set in a town that's of religious importance to the people who live there. And so that's going to color that. And I think that the main character herself is not too terribly religious. And so at first she's in this situation where she's in a surrounding that's very religiously oriented. But in the second half, she isn't really so much.
Well, that actually brings me up to something that that's related to this, since we're talking about this past city, as Paul was bringing up. There's not just a religious component, but also this very distinct class component mm-hmm. presented there. So you have the Oars and the Tanmind, mm-hmm. or Tanmind, depending on how you look at it.
Tanmind is usually how I...
Yeah, and I think there was one more, and I was trying to find the name, but I'm lost it. And one of the interesting things about that is it's not just that they're all on that they're clearly spatially delineated in terms of, like, the Oars are supposed to be the, quote, the underclass. And at one point, one of the characters refers to them as being from the underworld, which is a reference to the view of space. Actually, I should just let you talk about it, because I'm going to butcher it, and it's your novel, and you're amazing in that respect. So so actually talk about that, this class system, this idea of the quote-unquote underworld.
Well, the Tanmind, who it only comes up sort of tangentially, but religiously they believe that, some folks on Earth have constructed it, that heaven is the overworld, you know, heaven above and the underworld below and Earth in the middle, except the Tanmind are a spacefaring society, so they believe that the natural habitat of humanity is in space, and so in gravity wells is the underworld instead of underground, and out in the black, out in space, is where heaven is, where God is. So the Orsians live on a planet, and so they think of them as being people who live in the underworld, even not literally, obviously, but it has an effect on the way they think about it.
Yeah, and in fact, there's an interesting conflict that arises with Lieutenant An, who's the sort of superior for our main character in this past timeline. And one of the conflicts is the concern that somehow the Tanmind are being overlooked by the colonial authorities, would be the way to put it.
Yeah.
In terms of being considered for positions in, basically, in the colonial, the citizen service or civilian service, but part of the power structure, I guess. And I found that really interesting, because that's actually something that happens quite frequently in colonization, is after that's already happened and we've moved on from the sort of the violent overthrow portion, we now go into, well, how do we integrate people into this system? And basically what's being implied is there's actually corruption in the system itself, which is privileging one group over another.
Yeah. Well, and I think, in the real world, that's something that kind of happens, because if you're going to put people into your colonial administration, you want to put people there who you know are going to be friendly to your empire. And so those are generally going to be people who have the same interests and the same sympathies. And so it's going to come from one particular group of people. And of course, if you're also assuming that people from one group are a particular kind of person and people from another group are a different kind of person, you're going to pick from this group of people that you think is automatically more desirable, right? That was kind of what I was thinking of. Although in this case, it's a little more complicated than that, because really, to some extent, they are rewarding the Orshans for surrendering sooner, as the Time Mend actually make that accusation. You're really just rewarding them for being the first people to surrender, which is kind of true. So, yeah.
Oh, the Orshans, just stirring up trouble.
Yeah.
Paul, I see your hand
up. Yeah, I just want to make a comment that, now, while the polytheism and some other aspects remind me of the Roman Empire, that whole taking a small minority and putting them overlord over the rest of the population is very 19th and early 20th century British and French Empire.
It kind of is.
Yeah, I saw that. Like, oh, wow, that's kind of like what they did in Syria and Iraq.
Back
in the day. That's clever and devious and, well, leads to trouble in the novel, as well it should.
Yeah, it's a concept that, at least in the American version, is known as a benevolent despotism.
Mm-hmm.
Just this idea that you show up and you say, we're taking over because you can't take care of yourself, but we're going to teach you how to do that, and we'll put some of your people in positions of authority. It's what the U.S., just to kind of put it down into a nutshell, did with the Philippines. And obviously the British did it with many of its colonial properties as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be nicer than the other forms of colonization that preceded. How nicer is, I guess, up to speculation.
It probably depends on where you're standing at the moment. Yeah.
It's a little bit more psychologically abusive, I suppose, since it says we're nice and we're friendly, but at the same time, it's kind of, but we still think you're inferior.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like nice racism.
Kind of, yeah.
So, but it is interesting that you're actually exploring those things in this, because it was not, when I started reading it, I was like, well, A, the first chapter, we'll talk about something that happens in the first chapter that threw me for a loop, because I wasn't expecting it, but I was not expecting this kind of, this depth in dealing with these kinds of situations. I kind of expected that to get glossed over, and I was really excited to see that you're actually looking at, you know, how does somebody actually take care of a newly annexed territory, right? What is the political and the social and as Paul was pointing out, even the religious consequences of doing that? Because it's not like, you know, you walk in and you go, hey, you're annexed, have a nice day, right? It's a mm-hmm. complicated political, social, religious process.
Yeah, and I was sort of thinking about this before while I was thinking about things I wanted to say. And one of them is that I sat down to write a space opera where a whole bunch of stuff blew up, right? That was my main goal, was to write something where stuff blew up. And but I kind of wanted, when I read a book, I like stuff to blow up, but I like it to blow up in kind of a smart way. And so I wasn't necessarily trying to be groundbreaking or profound or anything, but I was like, okay, all my stuff is going to blow up. Really, though, if I think about it, how is it really going to blow up? And so I did spend a lot of time trying to do that. But ultimately, I just wanted to blow stuff up.
That's awesome.
And spoiler readers, stuff does blow up in this novel and blows up very well.
That's always good, though. It's good to have explosions. Well, if you're gonna have something that's like a space opera, at some point something has to explode.
You bet.
Yeah. So I already mentioned it, but it's something I did want to bring up, and I suspect it's something Paul was interested in talking about too, so we may bounce off each other in this. So it's layered throughout the book, but the very first chapter I had to stop and I go, okay, I need to reread what she just wrote, because if she's doing what I think she's doing, my head's going to explode, and I need to make sure I get it in there. But one of the things you sort of mess with is actually gender, and the way in which gender is assigned, and this is primarily through language, that certain languages, the way in which you describe somebody's gender actually may not necessarily apply to their like physical gender. It may apply to how they're presenting on the outside, and so the language you use actually determines whether you're being offensive when referring to somebody as something. And Breck, at least that's what she's calling herself, Breck, who's in the future, the present time, makes this big deal about, you know, if I get this wrong, I'm going to get shot in the face. Because I'm not in a fun position right now. So I was really interested in the gender role and the way in which you explore gender. And I was hoping you could talk a bit about sort of what you were trying to accomplish in this particular aspect.
Well, mostly what I was trying to do was to just handle a technical problem, which was that when I was designing the Rotch and the Rotchai, I said, oh, wouldn't it be fun, because you don't see this too often, to have a society where gender really and truly did not make a difference. That would be kind of cool. But then I would try to write about them, and I would have to use he and she, which was kind of frustrating because it didn't have the effect that I wanted. So I spent a long time thinking about that. And finally I said, you know what, I'm just going to use she as a default. And that ended up having a really interesting effect. And it made it really interesting to write about situations where Breck wasn't speaking Rotchai. So basically I was just trying to solve a technical problem, but it really had an interesting result, I think.
Paul?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm curious, Dan, if you've ever read The Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand.
I have read The Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand, although it was quite some time ago. I was in college when I read it, but yeah, I did.
Because I've recently been thinking about that book for reasons that will become more than clear by the time this episode drops. I wrote an article for Skipping and Fanti about it, and as I was thinking over the novel and thinking about it, I was like, wow. I saw the parallels between this and Anthony Joseph. I thought, I wonder if Anne read this, because I see a lot of parallels in handling pronouns and handling gender and those sorts of issues that Delaney brings up in that novel that you bring up, as Sean said before. At one point, she's not sure if she's going to get shot if she gets the pronoun wrong. I could see you going in Delaney's footsteps with the giant interstellar society where gender and sexuality are very fluid and very different from our own, and a sort of a lens to look at our own through that sort of difference. I was very curious if this was a coincidence or if you had consciously read it in the past.
Well, interestingly, I did read it in the past, but I read it so long ago that it wasn't until a day or two ago, I think, when somebody said, oh, this reminds me of Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand. And I was like, oh, I forgot I read that. So I did read it. At the time, I was really confused by it at first, and I found it very disorienting. That's something I really think I need to go back and reread. But I did read it, so it's entirely possible that that was part of what I was thinking about.
Yeah, I read it when I was 14, and I was mightily confused. It was my first Delaney. Like,
oh.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's Delaney is not one I would recommend for a very young mind.
No.
He can be, some of his stuff is okay, but I mean, even with like the Neverion tales, those at times, he deals with things like pedophilia in very, like very obvious ways. They're not metaphors, they're explicit.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there one that's an extended like sadomasochistic thing where the guy's getting tortured and, or am I misremembering that one?
You're probably right, and I've just forgotten which one that is. But I have a sneaking suspicion it's from the Neverion world. It may even be from Tales of Neverion, but I can't remember. I've totally forgotten. I remember there's a chapter in that book that involves a native population actually talking about the economics of trade.
Mm-hmm.
Like 30 pages. It's basically his version of the Council of Elrond scene, just minus the fishing. So he's very interesting in that way. Like, I find his work at times can be a bit too heady, but at the same time, it's the kind of work where he's doing something intentionally to explore a particular element. And sometimes it's him pushing buttons, and sometimes it's, you know, like, nobody ever writes about how a sort of tribal people actually susses out the economics of trade. Nobody ever talks about that except in sociology. So, you know, how does that actually work in something like a novel? And he tries to explore it. He explores other things as well, such as in Hog with 2 G's, which I think you should prepare yourself for that one. But
I'm probably not brave enough to read that one, and I am certainly not reading Valley and the Nest of Spiders or whatever.
Oh, yeah, the new one.
Which I've heard is fabulous and everything, and I'm sure it is, and I will take everyone's word for it, because it does not sound like my cup of tea.
I do appreciate that he's able to actually sort of push those boundaries, because I find that authors who do push the boundaries are also authors who help us figure out where the boundaries are.
Yeah, well,
those boundaries are never the same. They always shift and change.
Well, and if nobody pushes at them, I think they tend to constrict, right? And yeah. So I think it's really important for people to push at those. And, some pushing I have a lot more taste for, and some I find less comfortable. But I think it's valuable that it's uncomfortable. It's important that it be.
Well, and somebody's going to like it, and somebody will read it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Bizarro genre?
Only by name.
Okay. Paul, are you familiar with it?
Only by name.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of really great stuff that's written in it. And then there's stuff that I won't say it's not good. I would just say it's not my cup of tea. it's Bizarro is sort of like if you took the weird genre or like new weird and then you put it on, crack and PCP and cocaine at the same time.
Oh.
That would be what it's like. It's very pulpy at times, but it's also like insane. Just things that happen to it are pretty crazy. There's a lot of really interesting stuff because the things that they do, and there's some books where they'll explore sort of the horror of human nature by way of these sort of very extreme circumstances of people doing horrible things. And you can get to some of that terrifying, because that's what's more terrifying. It's not the acts they do. It's the fact that they're human, and mm-hmm. they're doing it to other humans, and that is rationalized in their own mindset. It's pretty terrifying. So sort of like American Psycho, I guess.
That I've read. Ooh.
Whew, that's I've only seen the movie. I've never read the book. I saw the movie, and I was very uncomfortable.
The book was very discomforting, yeah.
Is it in his perspective?
Yes. It's in first person.
Oh.
Wow.
Wow. I'm going to have to read it now just to see how I can do it. But I think you're right with when it comes to the lines, if nobody is pushing at the lines, they constrict until suddenly people who weren't maybe quote unquote pushing the boundaries suddenly are hitting the boundary. They're bouncing against it and realizing, wait, that wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then people are getting left out because the more you draw boundaries, right, the more you decide what's proper for telling stories about and what's not. And then suddenly you're only hearing one kind of story about one kind of person.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, I see you wanted to jump in a little while ago, so why don't you jump in?
I did. I just want to make a comment. Now I have a couple of things. So as far as drawing boundaries, one thing I did find interesting is that most, if not nearly all the characters in Ancillary Justice are women. I mean, there are men in this universe, but they're kind of in the background, just like in most space opera, it's the reverse. You have the men and women floating in the background. And in this novel, they're all women. What was up to the point of the Empress herself? And what was the motivation for that?
Well, to be honest, I'm not 100% sure there are a majority of women. It's kind of hard to tell when you have the same pronoun for everybody.
That's what I was thinking.
But that's the way it comes across to me.
That's the way it comes across. And that was, excuse me, that was one of the interesting effects of deciding to use she as a default pronoun. I'm actually not sure. Some of the characters, some of the major characters, I don't know if they're male or female. And occasionally I ask myself, does this novel pass the Bechdel test? And I don't know.
That's interesting. I would have said yes for sure, but now you got me wondering.
Well, that's the thing. But I kind of liked when I was done, I said, there will be people who will read this novel and say, oh gosh, there's nothing but women in this novel. And I said, you know what? I'm okay with that. I think that's cool. Because as you say, so often, even stuff that I loved as a kid written by women writers, I love like Andre Norton and Lee Brackett and C.J. Cherry. But you can still go and look at those and they'll be heavily populated with male main characters, which that's fine, but it's, as a woman reader, as a girl, like, well, where are all the girls? And so when using she as the default having that effect of making the novel seem like it's totally populated by women. I'm like, well, that's okay. That's cool. You know, if people come away with that impression, I don't mind that.
That was actually my other question was what space opera writers had you read? And you mentioned Cherry and Brackett and Moore. And anybody else comes to immediate mind that influenced your own space opera writing?
Another really big one would be Jack Vance.
I'm a Vance fan. I love it.
I love Vance. I really do. He can be kind of old fashioned, and I'm not sure I like the way he treats women all the time. But the language is so gorgeous and the world building is so amazing. Like these weird societies that do these things that you're like, that's just so totally bizarre. But I totally believe people would do that.
Yeah. And then you have people going into telephone booths on an advanced world. I thought, no, Jack, no.
Yeah.
But yeah, the world building and the language would keep bringing me back to Vance again and again.
Yeah, his language is amazing. And actually, I studied him. This was some years ago when my very first novel, which is in a drawer, and some people have seen it, but not many. Someone read it and said, "It's like you've got your hand over my eyes. I can't see anything. It's like everything's in black and white." And I said, "Well, all right. So who do I know who does really good visuals?" And so I spent like a year just reading Vance very closely, and he just does the most amazing visual images. They're really incredible.
Didn't the Sci-Fi Channel try to do one of his book series as a mini series?
No, you're thinking of Farmer.
Philip Jose Farmer. Wrong person.
No, Vance's stuff has not been adapted to screen large or small, and I think that's a crying shame, even though they would butcher it. But
because he did the Dying Earth.
He did the Dying Earth stuff, and plenty of novels set in his Oikoumene. I butchered that Greek universe with all sorts of weird stuff going on in a thousand different planets. All sorts of good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Demon Princes and the Alastor books and
Planet of Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually really interesting when you talk about classic authors who have not had their work adapted. And I think even though Clark has had some of his work adapted, I mean, 2001 is the sort of most obvious example. But people have been trying to do Rendezvous with Roma for probably longer than a decade, but easily the last decade they've been trying to get this thing off the ground, and I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know how much plot there is in Rendezvous with Rama. I mean, I really enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed reading it a lot, more than I expected to. But in the end, there's this giant thing, and we're going to travel across it.
And the characters are kind of lacking, too.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. I really enjoyed the heck out of it. But in the end, I was like, boy, there wasn't much of a plot there, was there?
But at the same time, it'll be Hollywood, so A, they wouldn't follow the book anyway.
No, they'd add a romance, and they'd, yeah.
Some sexy men, attractive women, be basically it.
Yep.
Yep. Idris Elba would play the lead character.
Oh, I would totally be there.
Yep. See? Done. I have just made the movie for them. That's all you need is just
That's
Idris Elba and some other random people, and just have Idris Elba talk.
Yep.
And while they're flying, and people will flock to go see it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
I would. I'd go see the Idris Elba movie. Idris Elba in a spaceship flying.
No plot. Outs. You don't need a plot.
You don't need a plot. Just let him talk. Just record
That's
it.
Right.
Just leave it on record and just piece together the stuff you get.
Mm-hmm.
For some weird reason, I think that might actually be a great pitch for a film. And that would just be the trailer. And nobody would have any idea what the hell it's about. They would just go to it.
They would, too.
Just like there would just be a voiceover. Like, we thought that we would make a regular movie, but then we decided not. So we just stuck Idris Elba in a room and said, talk. And that's how this movie came about.
It would be like My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah, it would be great.
My Dinner with Ildris.
Yeah.
That'd be great. But it's just kind of going back a little bit, but it is interesting, like Jack Vance, who hasn't had anything that I'm aware of be adapted. And there's lots of people they've done, Asimov's sort of his robot stuff, sort of. I mean, they did
sort of
iRobot, which is vaguely set in that universe, sort of.
Vaguely. Sort of.
But they haven't done, like, I know somebody is trying to do Foundation. I don't know how they're going to do Foundation, but, I mean, that's one of those examples of, since we're talking about your book and Empire, which is kind of related to your, this idea of, you know, the psychohistory of trying to limit the effects of a collapsing empire as its economy basically shuts down, and being able to predict that that's going to happen, you know, millennia before it ever does, and having to like put it things in place to stop it. I mean, that would be so fascinating, not as a like movie, but as a TV series.
It totally would. You're absolutely right. That would make a really great TV series.
Just the conflicts that would happen of watching this empire collapse, and we know it's going to collapse. We just, who is going to survive it?
Yeah.
Hollywood, call us.
HBO miniseries, here we come. No, that'll never happen. They'll never call.
Put some sharks in it and the Sci-Fi Channel would do it.
That's what's going to cause the collapse. It'll be space sharks.
Space sharks.
Oh my goodness. We've reviewed that movie, Sharknado. That's a special movie.
I have not seen it, although I saw Twitter explode when it was on, and I was like, this is amazing.
It's one of those movies where I think they made it intending it to be terrible. And it was.
You know, I read an interview, IO9 did an interview with the guy who wrote it, and that's exactly what it sounded like. It was like somebody had come up with this completely ridiculous thing, and we're like, boy, that'll be completely ridiculous. Let's go ahead and do it, you know.
Which I guess is kind of a, you know, if that's what you're intending to do, we're going to make something and just crazy, and who cares? It doesn't need to have a consistent plot, just crazy idea, crazy character archetypes, go. I guess that kind of works. If it was like, oh, I really believed this is going to be my magnum opus, and it was going to be like my Stanley Kubrick making 2001, and I think that would be the point at which we would go, oh, come on, guy. No.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I mean, that kind of has its own sort of charm, you know, like Ed Wood, because at least I've heard he really believed he was making great films, right? And there's something kind of charming about that he was really giving it his all, and what he got was Plan 9 from Outer Space, but he was trying really hard, you know.
Like the Birdemic guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who was, I think, believes his films are good. And if you see Birdemic, it's not good. At all.
Unless you're Jen.
Unless you're Jen, who's rarely on this show anymore, who apparently really... And no, she's never seen that movie. It wasn't Jen.
Oh, it was
Julia.
Oh, it was Julia. My bad.
She liked half of the movie.
Half? Well, that's pretty good.
I'm not sure which half she liked. I think it was the first half, which is the half that's really boring and horrible as well. With random Eastern European people saying lines and then disappearing. Among other issues. Anyway, I'm sorry. We're totally going far afield, but where were we before we were all on this movie stuff?
I have no idea.
We were on empires and Vance, and why don't we just jump to a completely different topic?
Yeah, go for it, Paul.
Jump cut. Right. So this is your first novel, then? Have you written many stories before? You mentioned a trunk novel before.
Yeah,
I want to talk about you and your background in writing.
I have two trunk novels, actually, which may or may not ever see the light of day. So I was one of those people who always wanted to be a writer from when I was a kid, but never really like wrote as much as I probably should have. Or, you know, every now and then I would like send something out and it would get rejected. Although I did, when I was in college, I sent a story to True Confessions and it sold. So that was actually officially my first sale, but it didn't get a byline, so I guess it didn't count. And then I didn't write anything for a long time. And then I had a baby. And the thing about babies, they're really cute. And it's nice to be home taking care of your baby, except when you're not talking to grown-ups on a regular basis, your brain kind of starts to leak out your ears. And so I was like, I have to do something, or I'm just going to... there's not going to be anything of my brain left. And so I started sitting down trying to write, and I did NaNoWriMo, which I am a big supporter of NaNoWriMo. I think they're fabulous. I know sometimes people diss them, and they don't deserve to be dissed. I think NaNoWriMo is wonderful. And when I was done, at the end of that first attempt, I had the first draft of a novel. And it actually, it wasn't great, but it wasn't anywhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I was like, well, maybe I can do this. And so I wrote the two trunk novels, and I was like, no, I got to trunk these. And then I started trying to write short fiction. So I've actually sold maybe two dozen short fiction, two dozen pieces of short fiction. And then said, well, now it's time to turn back around and do the novel again. But so that's basically, I've spent, I went to Clarion West in 2005 and made my first short fiction sale in at the end of 2005. And then I'd been selling short fiction up until then.
I'm not a giant short fiction reader, so I never came across your name until we started hearing about this novel. So you're not eligible for the Campbell Award next year.
No, I am not. I have not been eligible for the Campbell Award for quite some time. Yeah, the Campbell Award really tilted towards people who publish novels, which is fine, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of people who were, I think Mer Lafferty was on there this year primarily for her short fiction. And the year prior was for, I think, a novel.
Actually, I think her novel
novel just came out.
That's right, yeah, because it just hit, yeah.
Yeah, and actually My Girl Zen Cho was on there for her short fiction. I was really glad to see her on there this year because I just love her work. I think her work is fabulous. But it's not, I think usually the people who are on the Campbell or who win the Campbell have had a novel. Because, of course, you know, more people see it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think everybody else on there, I think they've all got novels, except maybe one other than Merv. I can't remember. Yeah. But, like, Sina was on there. I mean, she's written some short stories, but everybody knows her for her sort of Irish fairy. God, that's a terrible way to put it. Her Irish Troubles novels involving urban fantasy elements. she was on there. Let's see, we had Chuck Wendig, who is primarily urban fantasy, although he's now in YA, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Who else was on there? Max Gladstone, who also was sort of secondary world urban fantasy. Mm-hmm. What the hell is with the urban fantasy? It's like taking over the Campbell.
Well, it's popular, right?
People it's like true. It. Yeah, it is pretty darn popular. So, yeah. It's working. I still think space opera should be the big genre. But
you know, space opera, it's wonderful. I love it. But I think it goes through phases, and it can get very hidebound and old-fashioned and conservative and kind of start to repeat itself. But I think every genre can do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, even something like epic fantasy become sort of... I want to say insular, but I feel like that's offensive. but you know, it becomes repetitive, and it doesn't want to push its own boundaries. And then someone comes along like an N.K. Jemisin and says, "No, we're not going to play that game anymore."
Yeah. Oh, I like her work so much.
Yeah. She's really good. I like her stuff. Her fantasy work is really great. Because it's not playing into, like, yeah, they're epic fantasies and they involve a lot of the trappings and magic and stuff. But at the same time, she's dealing with different types of cultures and different types of characters that we normally see in epic fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And no chosen ones.
No. Well, and she's asking questions about it. Like, well, now, wait a minute. Why does this have to be like this?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Like with The Killing Moon. Yeah. I really like that book. That was a really good book. But yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
So yeah, so you've written a science fiction novel. Are your stories science fiction, fantasy, or both, Anne?
So my first short fiction sale was science fiction, and then after that, I couldn't sell a science fiction story to save my life. And so the vast majority of my short fiction that has sold is secondary world fantasy. I think I've only sold one other science fiction short story, and everything else was secondary world fantasy.
So why science fiction for your novel then? Just because you couldn't sell any short science fiction? Where do you feel more home at, science fiction or fantasy, if you come down to it?
I'm not sure I could pick one. At the beginning, when I went to Clarion West, I only had those two novels and like one short story that I had ever written. And of course, I wrote a bunch more at the workshop. And I was only doing science fiction, and I was thinking I can't really do fantasy because it's not really me. But when I started trying to do fantasy, I really got on a roll with the fantasy, and I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying this. And I had the idea for this novel quite some time ago, around about the time I was at Clarion West, so that would have been 2005. And So when I turned around and I said, well, if I'm going to write a novel, in fact, I was talking to Rachel Swirsky, who she likes my fantasy short stories. And she's like, you should totally write a novel in your fantasy universe. And I said, well, that would probably be a good idea because the short stories sell and they generally get good comments. But I want to go back to the science fiction thing. And I was kind of afraid of it at first because I hadn't been doing the science fiction for a while. But I got back into it and I was like, no, I'm really feeling this. So I don't think I can really say that one or the other is more congenial to me.
So clearly there are sequels, hopefully, for Ancillary Justice coming along. Will you ever write a fantasy novel? Do you have any ideas for that?
I have some very vague ideas for that. And I know that I'm actually under contract for 3 books. So the Ancillary Justice is out. And hopefully I'll turn an Ancillary Sword really, really soon. And then I'll have to turn in number 3. And then after that, I'll have to start thinking about what it is I want to do. And I guess that'll depend on what my agent thinks is the best thing to do, what editors who I need to talk to might think is the best thing to do, because of course I want to do something that's going to sell. But I also, it's really important to me to do something that I want to do. So I haven't really made any concrete plans, but certainly fantasy is definitely a possibility, and it's something I kind of been turning over in my mind. What would I do if I decided to go fantasy for my next big project?
Awesome. I mean, from what I've just seen in the blogosphere, Ancillary Justice has gotten a lot of positive press and love from the genre community, and I do hope it sells well as getting that positive press. I mean, I loved it. Sean loved it. Mm-hmm. I've seen nary anything other than effusive praise. I didn't realize you had written all the short stories and the truck novels, but I can see that clearly was the building blocks to making this a really excellent book.
Yeah, I have actually seen a couple of less than effusive reviews, but not as many as I expected. I have to admit that when I wrote this and I finished it, I was convinced that it would never sell. I was sure it was unsellable, but I sent it around anyway and hooked myself an agent. And then he started sending it around, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. He's such a nice young man, and I'm going to be a terrible disappointment to him. He's never going to be able to sell this. And he sold it right off. So this has all been like incredibly surprising to me. I mean, I believe it's a good book or I would not have sent it out. And it was really important to me to do the book I wanted to do. But I was kind of afraid that having done that book, that maybe it was only the book I wanted and nobody else was going to really, you know, be feeling it. And so it's been really exciting and really gratifying and also actually very terrifying to see so many people just say such amazing things. It's been incredible.
Well, it's got to be overall a good experience to realize that so many people like it and there's not as much hate, because our community has a tendency to sometimes rage about things, and sometimes they rage about books. I mean, I remember when George R. R. Martin released the fifth of his Song of Ice and Fire book, and there are a lot of positive reviews, but if there are a lot of people who are like, this book sucks, it's not as good as the other ones, and they just ripped it to pieces. They also went after him because apparently, you know, waiting for a decade is not...
Kept them waiting so long.
Oh, yeah, poor babies.
But, you know, I guess readers, once the book is out of my hands, really whatever reaction a reader is going to have is a valid reaction. So when I've come across the ones that are less than entirely complimentary, I'm like, okay, they get to have that reaction. That's, you know, and they have every right to say whatever it is that they need to say. And I need to just step away and not take it personally, because I really do feel that readers ought to be able to have whatever reaction they're going to have and not be told, oh, no, that's wrong. Or, oh, no, you just don't understand. Or, no, you read it. You had that reading experience. That's your reading experience.
This actually goes to something that our community was recently discussing. And I'm glad that you brought this up, because it was a question that I might have asked if you'd gone down this route, and you did, so I'm going to ask it anyway. But recently our community was having a discussion about whether or not authors should engage with fans in fan spaces like a blog or something when their work is being discussed. And It seems in your case, you say that as a general rule, don't engage, you know, that because you see that the review, even if it's a horrifyingly mean review, it's still valid in its own right, and to engage is perhaps detrimental to the conversation?
So I've been lucky enough not to see anything horrifyingly mean about my book, I'll have to say. So I don't know what that really feels like. But I would say that by and large, there's probably no really compelling reason to step into a conversation. If there's maybe a matter of fact that can be easily cleared up, maybe. But I think I saw that conversation go down, and I felt that certain parties were being really kind of jerks. I felt the author was not behaving as well as perhaps they might have. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to say, no, authors can't speak. On the other hand, what's the point of speaking? What is it you're trying to do when you speak? And if what you're trying to do is change the mind of the person who has given this review, or if what you're trying to do is tell them how they're so totally wrong about your book, then that gets into stepping on the fact that the reader gets to have their experience of the book. I think that if a reviewer or a fan space is open to having that, then that's awesome and cool. But even so, I suspect that stepping in tends to, you kind of have the last word on it. And so, you know, if I go in and say, well, actually, this is the interpretation, well, then suddenly there's nothing to discuss anymore. And half of the fun of those comment threads is the discussion, the back and forth. Oh, what if it's this? So what if it's this? And it's people thinking about it and chewing over it. And why would I want to stop that?
Right, because if they're having a conversation, even a negative conversation, it can be good. Because mm-hmm. you can produce, you can add to that discussion. I mean, I feel like even, you know, this is maybe common knowledge, but the idea that a negative review, like, you shouldn't think horribly about it, because even sometimes negative press is good press.
Yeah, yeah. I've met folks occasionally talking in private who say, oh, but these bad reviews here, it's affecting my, and I'm like, no, because, you know, people know what to think when they read it, and they'll say, oh, that sounds like something that I would agree with or that I would not agree with. This horribly negative comment, they're saying they don't like it for some reason that tells me actually I would kind of like the book, right?
Exactly. You know,
people don't look at something and say, oh, there's a 1-star review, I guess I won't like it.
Not as a general rule, yeah.
And
at least not with
say,
literature.
Yeah, and as you say, there's pretty much all publicity is good publicity, right? I mean, unless you're doing something horrible like barbecuing kittens on TV or something, that would not help your book sales, right? But really, there's no reason to jump in and defend yourself. Now, there are things if it were to come to outright harassment or defamation or stalking or that kind of, that's a totally different thing. That's things that are genuinely abusive. But I don't think your book sucks is genuinely abusive.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it wouldn't even hold up in a court.
No.
You have to actually go into sort of libel territory for that. Like, somebody would have to literally say, this book is obvious evidence that he's a Nazi, and here's why he's a Nazi, just because I'm going to go with the absurd example. I'm not even sure that would hold up in court.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of feel like reviewers really need to be given their space, and if they want to engage, that's awesome. But if they don't want to engage, really probably the best thing to do is say, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll back off. And really, that's just like common politeness, isn't it?
Yes.
That's what astonished me about that situation where the person jumped in and the blogger said, please no. And the response was not, oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
The response was, no, I'm going to tell you 400 times why I am going to come in here and step all over you. And so I got kind of frustrated with the people who were championing that author as, well, they have every right to speak their mind. I'm like, well, they do, but they were really being a jerk.
Yeah, I feel like me as a wannabe sort of half-assed published writer, and somebody who does review books and does something like this podcast, where I actually interact with authors such as yourself, I feel like for me, if I write a review and an author wants, even if I write like a review where I say something critical, I'm much more pleased if an author were to come in and say, you know, I hadn't thought about this thing you just said. That's very interesting. Could you elaborate more?
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's clear, like, we're going to have a dialogue. Like, even if I don't like something about the book, we can discuss it. And that the way in which that person's come in and approached it is clearly they want to actually learn from this scenario.
Yeah. They want it to be a dialogue, not telling you what to think. Yeah.
Right. Instead of coming in and saying, you know, well, I totally didn't do that. And I'm like, well, that's the point at which you got your asshole points.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, yeah, I understand you may not have intended to do that, but that's what I saw.
Yeah.
You know, and it's possible I could be wrong, but, you know, yelling at me is probably not a good way to get there.
Not generally.
Yeah. You know, but I agree. Like, as a general rule, it's probably just best for authors not to engage. And if they are going to engage, do so like with, you know, on tiptoes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and being very willing to back off if they're told, really, actually, we just want to be fans talking about it. Yeah.
Right. You know, yeah. If somebody says I'm uncomfortable, it's like, oh, okay, I apologize and back up. Just, mm-hmm. you know, because it's not a good idea to make your potential fans uncomfortable. But I think so. But, you know, I guess there's a lot of creepy people in Hollywood. So, you know, I mean, who knows? Anyway, so kind of going to go back to the book really quick. Well, maybe not so much the book, but more a question that I hadn't asked you, which is usually our intro question, which is, so you've mentioned, you know, some classic writers you read. So, you know, Andre Norton, Jack Vance, Brackett, etc. What I'm curious now is what today keeps you coming back to genre fiction? Obviously, since Paul's already brought up that you also have a love for fantasy and that you can't pick between the genres, I'm going to make that very wide. So any genre that you so choose to love to read, what is it that keeps you coming back to it as a reader and, by extension, as a writer?
I think science fiction and fantasy both. What I really like is the potential to really ask questions that are harder to ask in sort of the more realistic traditions, so that you can turn things around and just really change reality. I think things like a couple of books I really loved recently. I loved The City and the City so much, and Embassy Town. But The City and the City took something real and just kind of twisted it around in the most amazing way. That's the kind of thing that I love. And I'm obviously Miebel's not the only person doing that. And a lot of things that are more sort of popcorn-y do similar things just on a different level, maybe not so intensely. But it's really fun to see the way that the world can be twisted around and looked at from a different angle. I think that's the thing that I really like the best.
Well, and you do some of that yourself. I mean, I keep going back to that first chapter. But that was, I'm sure Paul and probably Anne, you're familiar with it, this idea of, you know, I think what Suvin calls the novum, and that's probably a term that's been used by others too, but this new flashy idea that suddenly jolts you into awareness that you are no longer in your own world,
mm-hmm.
but you're somewhere else. I guess Suvin would probably say something like cognitive estrangement. Or in the case of Delaney, he would talk about like the way you read this introductory chapter, you can't just read it like it's regular fiction, because the cues that are in the language itself are telling you the things that are different from our present. I mean, the gender alone, the way in which gender pronouns are discussed, or even the setting, that all changes. And I feel like that's what you're trying. The thing that you very much love about science fiction and fantasy, that kind of jolt is exactly what is going on with this, where it's like, you know, we're being shoved into this whole new world, and, you know, it's like high octane, like you're not going to stop because this whole world is going to throw you for a loop. I liked it. So if it's not already clear that I like the book.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's an awesome thing to hear. I think doesn't Delaney talk about like reading protocols where he says, actually, the sentence won't make sense. It literally doesn't make sense if you don't understand that you need to be reading it as though it's set somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really interesting way of looking, because he looks at science fiction. Like, lots of people talk about what science fiction is. They're trying to actually define it as what it is. And Delaney doesn't, like, based on my sort of very loose understanding of Delaney, he hates that idea of, like, trying to define something that's indefinable. So he just says, screw it. We're not going to talk about what science fiction is. We're going to talk about what it does. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't think there is any way to define it.
No, there isn't.
Go
ahead.
You'll never find a satisfying definition that fits for all cases, that has no ambiguities. It's never going to happen.
Right. I mean, if you go to the Wikipedia page for science fiction, they've got like 20 bazillion different definitions on that page. Mm-hmm. So it's much more interesting to talk about what science fiction does, or in the case of fantasy, you know, what fantasy does and how it operates. And with science fiction, in Delaney's case, the language, right down to the language, science fiction operates on a different level. So what words have different meanings in this other context?
Mm-hmm.
Or in some cases, as you've already suggested, some sentences literally make no sense in a realistic world.
Yeah.
So, and I imagine we could find some in your book that if, you know, characters are referring to characters as he and she, and when we think it's one gender and it's like, no, that's not what's going on, wouldn't work in our world, because we don't have daily conversations about, you know, which gender pronoun is the appropriate pronoun.
Yeah, well, you'd never say a sentence, you would very rarely, let me say it this way, you would very rarely say a sentence like, well, she's male. I think she's male. You wouldn't, in English, you wouldn't normally say that. I can actually think of cases in which maybe you would say something like that, but they would be kind of very contrived situations.
Sure, sure. And they'd be very rare circumstances. They wouldn't be very common circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the average person probably does not know somebody who is, for example, a transgender. Although it's possible that everybody knows one and they just don't realize
it. And even in that situation, let's say you're talking about somebody who's transgender, really you wouldn't say she's male, because person is male, you would say he's male, or if you weren't trying to be a jerk, right? So that would be it. That would be the contrived situation, would be somebody who was trying to make a point that would be kind of a jerky point. Normally you wouldn't say that.
At the same time, I think it would be somewhat normal to say she's male, not because that's the right thing to say, but because people – I think the fact that there are so few, at least I'm assuming there are so few people who are transgender, that it's – and they're not as prevalent in mainstream sort of media. So like, there aren't a lot of TV shows that feature transgender characters, at least not in positive roles, whereas some like gay characters are – fairly prominent now. I mean, you basically almost every TV show has a gay character. But this idea that, you know, somebody who doesn't know how to engage with some, you know, or talk about somebody who is transgender, they could make that mistake and say she's male.
That's true. Somebody who was sincerely just didn't understand how to and was trying to work it through, they could say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I've done that. I still do it occasionally. I make these stupid mistakes with the pronouns. And thankfully, the people I've done it with have been very kind.
They've been very understanding.
Have it just explained, like, I prefer this pronoun. It's like, okay, then I can try to commit it to memory. But it's something where if you don't experience it, your reactions aren't don't get codified as sort of your normalized reaction. Whereas, like, if I talk about somebody who's gay, I just go, they're gay, what if?
Yeah, well, you know. It's interesting. That's one of the things that was very interesting to me, was to see how hard-coded those sets of assumptions are, because they're not necessarily true assumptions. The things that we think of as signaling particular genders aren't necessarily inescapable. And it's kind of interesting to when I had my first kid, and when you take a baby to the grocery store, it's really amazing. People don't know how to interact with a baby unless they know what gender that baby is.
Yeah, because of our behavior, what we assume is normalized behavior for certain genders.
Mm-hmm. And so you dress a kiddo up in green, and you don't put a headband on him or something, and it's amazing the thing people will stop. They won't even they'll turn, lean over to smile and then turn to you and say, wait a minute, is this boy or a girl? Or if they'll guess, I've had them guess, and it's been a long time since my kids were babies, but I've had people guess and then say, oh, wait, and realize they had guessed the wrong choice, and then be very apologetic, like they just kicked my dog or something. And I'd be like, well, how could you possibly know? She's a baby. And why is it such a big deal? And I found that really interesting. And so one of the things I was kind of thinking about was, you know, gender is very much who you are. Gender is a part of who a person is, but it isn't necessarily the way that we assign them, doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what a person's gender is. It's not an inescapable thing, but it's interesting how hard-coded that is, how difficult it is to step away from those things. Because even though I've had this experience with my kids, and I like to think that I'm not bound by all these prejudices and stuff, I totally am. And it's very hard to get away from those, that set of assumptions. It's really interesting.
It's really deep in our cultural DNA, and I hadn't thought about the whole baby thing, but yeah, I've come across a situation where I don't know the gender, and I felt awkward not knowing that piece of information, and that's very strange, but it's true.
Give you a tip. All babies probably don't have a problem with the baby voice.
This is exactly right, and babies smile back at you, and if you say, oh, aren't you adorable, there isn't a parent in the world who won't take that well. But it's interesting how I read somewhere they had done some research somewhere where they would dress babies up and bring adults in, and they would dress babies up according to different gender expectations. And then they'd ask the people, well, so what gender was this baby? And the people would say, oh, well, this was obviously a little boy. And it, because you could see he was so strong and so rambunctious, and it never actually matched up to what the kids' genders are. It all had to do with what they were assuming.
And we're looking for things to match with that. So things like he's rambunctious and all these things. Well, is he really? Or did you make that up or did you see it because that was your perception of his gender?
And then the next question is, of course, a lot of times people will say, oh, but, you know, I had kids, and like from when they could crawl, the little boy was interested in trucks and the little girl was interested in dolls. And you're like, yeah, but do you realize that from the moment they were born, you've been differentiating according to how you've assigned the gender, and you've been subtly encouraging this from the one and encouraging this from the other from the moment that they come home from the hospital. And so it's really, it seems like it's totally natural, but then when you turn around and look at the way people treat the kids differently, it doesn't seem quite as natural anymore.
Yeah, it was something over the weekend, my friends and I were having this discussion about, and I realize this is tangentially related to your book, but it's a very interesting discussion. The idea of, like, what are you going to do when we have kids? Because none of us have kids yet. And we're like, well, you know, like, well, we'll raise our kids this way and that way. And we had this kind of a debate about whether or not, you know, we're going to raise our kids with gender expectations. And this was bouncing off of this story about the guy who let his, it must have been like 6-year-old boy dress up in a dress, like a pink mm-hmm. dress, and took him out and like let him dress however he wanted. And my thought was, like, I don't care. Like, if other people have a hissy fit, I'm going to have a discussion with my kid and be like, well, other people are stupid. But and that maybe is just my naive utopian view of how I would raise a kid. But
yeah, the first time you take the kid to daycare or to school, everybody else will tell them they are not conforming, and they will tell them in no uncertain terms.
Yeah. And I don't know how to get around that. You can't.
You can't. You really can't. You can just kind of do the best you can and say, well, honey, you know. Yeah.
It sucks.
It's really hard to work against. And it's very difficult when you're a person who your personality doesn't match up to whatever society's expectations are for whatever gender you've been assigned. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah. I wish there was a way to sort of, because, like, I feel like a kid dressing up in a dress, like, you know, at 6 years old, is he going to want to dress in a dress his whole life? Probably not. You know, mm-mm. Maybe he will be. Maybe he'll love dresses, and that'll be his thing. It's like, great, that's fine. But most likely he'll grow out of it, right? Mm-hmm. He'll be like, I don't really want to wear dresses. I want to wear t-shirts and, you know, shorts.
Yeah.
But we live in a society where, like, our kids can't just be allowed to, like, explore that and just kind of figure it out for themselves. We sort of have to, like, we have to basically step in and be like, you have to be this way because that's the way society's telling us you have to be.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of anxiety around that, isn't there? Yeah. Oh, well, what if he's going to wear a dress for the rest of his life? Well, what are the chances of that? I mean, are you still doing what you wanted to do at 6?
No? What the hell did I want to do at 6? I think I just wanted to capture toads.
I wanted to be an astronaut, actually.
I wanted that at, 9. And then I found I had asthma, and they'd never let me in, and then my dreams were crushed. So, I still would like to be an astronaut, but...
My eyesight meant I'd never be an astronaut or a pilot.
Wouldn't the astronauts be... That'd be, a cool job. At least it seemed like it when you were a kid, and then you realize how little everybody cares about astronauts. It's like, but they're awesome.
And how infrequently you actually get to go up in space, right? Although, I guess it's maybe... There's more missions going on now than when I was a little kid, but...
Well, not right now, because NASA's shut down.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious today. It just is a random thing, but one of the TVs that is at my college in this place where everybody goes and hangs out and gets coffee is for the NASA feed. And so the NASA feed today was just the image that said, we're sorry, but our feed is currently out because we don't have any funding to run it. And it should have just said, also, since we don't have no funding, nothing would be interesting to show you, so...
You're just showing an empty office all day.
That would have been great if they could have, scrounged together the money and just show an empty office with a sign that says, this is what NASA's like when it has no money, which is nothing. But alas. So we totally went far afield and had an interesting discussion on gender and gender roles. But let's actually get to these sort of the final questions. Unless, Paul, you have any last major thing you want to discuss?
No, but I think we should start wrapping this up. We've kept Anne for longer, and she's been very gracious about this.
This is true.
It's been fun. It's okay.
So big question first. We kind of know a little bit of this, but what can folks expect from you in the near future?
In the near future, hopefully I will turn in Ancillary Sword, which is the sequel to Ancillary Justice. I know the notes in the back, my editor said, it's going to be a loose trilogy. He was not aware that it was not really going to be a loose trilogy. It's a pretty direct sequel. So that's going to get turned in come hell or high water very soon. And then, of course, I need to start into Ancillary Mercy, which would be the third book in the trilogy. And after that, I just don't know.
Excellent. Well, why don't we get to our silly questions 5 then? You ready?
All right.
So these would be quick, hopefully quick. So don't think about them too much. So would you rather be a sentient robot or the same personality spread across dozens of human bodies?
Oh, I think I would take the dozens of human bodies.
Interesting. All right. Number 2, would you rather have space moonshine or a pangalactic gargle blaster?
Pangalactic gargle blaster.
Excellent. You don't care about your brain cells. That's good to know. Number 3.
Well, moonshine. Do you know what they put in moonshine sometimes?
Turpentine?
All kinds of stuff, right?
It's moonshine. You don't know what's in it.
You don't know what's in it. I know there's a gold brick in a pangalactic gargle blaster, so I'm good.
Oh, well, that's true. And a little bit of lemon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's good. All right. Well, number 3, a writer you'd most like to see run for political office.
Oh,
and it doesn't have to be a serious answer. This is, you could be totally goofy.
I don't know. Maybe not any of them. I mean, writers are fabulous people, but running politics, I have discovered that politics, I love politics in stories, right? Because you can do all this maneuvering and drama and stuff, but in real life, it's really upsetting and frustrating.
That's true.
So I don't think I would wish that on any of the writers that I know.
Okay, we'll switch it from political office to writer you'd most like to see be a teacher.
Ooh. Once again, well, I think Jack Vance probably would have made a great teacher. C.J. Cherry herself was a teacher. She taught high school Latin, as I recall.
Oh.
It was probably really good.
I bet, yeah. All right, well, both of those would be acceptable answers. All right, number 4, ray gun or laser sword?
Laser sword.
Yes, you made the right choice.
Space opera. That's, my personal dividing line. If there's a technologically advanced society, I don't care what your justification is, if they fight with swords, it's a space opera. You can have the most hard physics reason for why they're fighting with swords, but it doesn't matter. It's a space opera.
Well, they do fight with old school weaponry and the Forever War, but they have a perfectly good reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, in case anybody's not read it, but now you have to read it, so I'm not going to tell you. So,
the 6 people who haven't read it.
Yeah, the 6 people who haven't read it, what is wrong with those people? No, that's not right. That's all. All right, number five, science fiction world you'd least like to live in.
Oh, boy, there's a bunch of them, aren't there?
Yeah.
I mean, you start with Brave New World and just go on from there, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You could start there.
Yeah, that'll be my answer, I think.
Brave New World, not going to live there, huh?
Mm-mm.
Excellent. Well, perfect. So that pretty much does it. We've asked you lots of really compelling questions, had a lovely discussion about gender roles, and it was really great to have you on to talk about your book, Ancillary Justice, Anne.
Well, thank you very much for letting me talk about my book.
Yeah, and thank you, Paul, for joining me as my co-answery, question-y person.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I love this book, and I love talking with Anne about it.
Perfect. And so just everybody remembers, you just send us a message telling us your favorite science fiction book, and you could possibly win a copy of Ancillary Justice. By the time this episode goes up, it's going to already be out because we're recording after it supposedly went out anyway on the 1st of October. So you should go buy the book and then buy 7,000 more copies or the equivalent in whatever you can manage without going broke. And then just give them to all your friends.
I hardly endorse that idea.
Fair enough. I like how you put that. Hardly endorse.
One last bit, Anne. Where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at annlecky.com, in fact.
Perfect. So, and we'll make sure there's links to that in the show notes. So on that note, we'll see everybody next episode.
Good night, everyone.
Night. Good night.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.